Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Today's Healthcare Consumption, the Changing Landscape of Consumer Interest and Access to Providers, Testing, and Information. The presenters are Scott Maddle, President, Boston Heart Diagnostics Eurofins, Boston, Massachusetts, and Brad Seibert, President CEO, My One Medical Source, Westlake, Ohio.
Well, thank you for being here, 8:30 on a day after New Orleans night. I want to introduce Scott Maddle, the president of Boston Heart Diagnostics, part of Eurofins. If you're not familiar with Boston Heart's focused on the treatment and prevention of disease by offering novel diagnostics that drive a personalized approach to patient health. I'm very familiar with them as I helped start Cleveland Heart Lab. We worked in coordination with Boston Heart all over the country. Myself, I'm Brad Seibert, president of My One Medical Source. What we have is a solution that helps increase access to care by increasing access to the labor to draw blood, collect specimens for labs, clients all over the country, in an approach that's convenient, compliant, and quality process driven. But today, what we're going to talk about is today's healthcare consumption, the changing landscape of consumer interest and access to providers, testing, and information. And obviously here at the War College, a lot of things have happened already since we've been here with LDTs and access to testing, but we won't get into that, the depth of that. We just want to talk about what the market looks like. So they've changed the font in our presentation, and it doesn't look very pretty. It looks like an old typewriter. So what we'll start off with today, just like to present an agenda, is really to start off to really talk about how consumers are changing the way they access healthcare. And I always talk about a consumer. I don't believe they become a patient until they're actually being treated or tested, et cetera. So that's the definition we'll work with today. We'll talk about the virtual health and the virtual exams, telehealth, access to symptom checkers, novel ways that people are getting more information, and then an interest in consumer-initiated testing or direct access testing, direct-to-consumer testing. Then we'll also talk about labs. Scott will talk about how they're addressing consumer access for their testing. Then we'll come back to talking about the consumer, their willingness to pay for out-of-pocket expenses, be it mobile draws, access to care, virtual visits, et cetera. And then flip it back to Scott and how they're working with virtual care models to address their patients for their lab to exceed. And then at the end, we'll talk about other self-collection devices that make it easier for testing and get in the hands of patients. So really, to move forward, you got to look backwards, right? So I found this study, or this article from 68 years ago from Saz Hollander. And it really, the patient-physician relationship and how it's evolved, it went from an active, passive model, patients lay in there, the doctor's making a decision, the emergency type of situation, to the guidance and cooperation model. Patient comes in to see a physician. Physician tells them what they need to do. Here's how we're going to play it. And then the mutual participation model. Hey, doc, I have this problem. Let's make it happen. So that's the traditional way. Well, today's healthcare consumer and the shift, you know, everybody expects convenience, affordability, and quality. Younger consumers, we all have them. We all know them. They're not satisfied with the status quo. They want cutting edge and not traditional delivery methods. And then non-traditional healthcare, such as virtual care and the rise of that popularity. I like to call a lot of that acceleration, the COVID effect, as we all know, it made us make different decisions. So the overview of virtual health. So let's define what virtual health really means. And I apologize for these slides. I mean, that's just awful. I would plug in my own computer, but so virtual care, you know, as the definition of virtual health, it's your telehealth, your remote patient monitoring, online appointments and schedules that you're doing with healthcare providers. And then you obviously, there's the definition of telemedicine or telehealth, right? The delivery of the technology to get that clinical healthcare service and diagnosis. And what's funny or interesting for the CDC that in 2021, right, the first real year after the beginning of COVID, that at least 37% of adults had used telehealth within the last 12-month period. That makes sense. And then digital health. I find this very interesting because that's why we're here. You're talking about all the delivery of technology, et cetera. So it's the combination of the mobile apps, the wearables, the websites, the EMRs, and technologies that's used to monitor patients and track health data. The stat that I love the most is that in 2021, private equity, venture capital invested over $29 billion because they saw this as the acceleration of access to healthcare. So, again, the slide and the font's not very good, but virtual health is becoming more accessible. We all see it. You know, everybody's trying to get into the game from different modes. Virtual healthcare visits available online, you know, without insurance, cash pay, 10 to 50 bucks, you know, $59 with your insurance, but everyone's trying to give a different delivery mechanism to get access to the patient to get the kind of care and the services they need. We see it even more for telehealth, right? We want you this to be convenient. We get access to doctors on your schedule, accessibility, convenience for you and using technology. So the players that are trying to get the 24/7, you know, for the telehealth, the MD, WebMDs, Teladoc, et cetera, they're just trying to deliver the access to care that people are seeking. Even the biggest players in consumer reach and logistics are in play. Amazon, we all know the big buy of One Medical, but even in their digital presence with Amazon Clinic Online, everybody's trying to get the delivery of care. But technology has evolved in a lot of different ways for deliverability of access. I don't know if you're familiar with Buoy Health, but Buoy Health is a technology platform using an algorithm that reaches out to employers and their employees to deliver a symptom checker. What's fascinating about what they've done is they've taken an algorithm driven with 7,000 use cases, diagnosis, and treatments, options, into a survey that people take when they join, go to the website. The traction they're getting is amazing. In 2020, they did over 35 million unique visitors to the website who took this symptom checker survey. 67% of the people who go to the site take the survey, and they deliver a next step of what actions to take. Last year, this increased to 46 million. So the interest is there for people to find out, hey, something's going on with me, give me a deliverability. But what they're also finding, by using this technology up front, there's been a cost reduction overall to the person and to the insurance. And it's also allowed less of a burden to the health system of trying to uncover what's going on with the patient. Direct-to-consumer testing market, the consumer-initiated ordering I was talking about before. Prior to COVID, and this is the space that I helped start My One Medical Source for, direct-to-consumer testing was estimated to be about $350 million. With the opening of genetic counseling and more accessibility to physicians online and telehealth, they're now estimating that direct-to-consumer testing market will exceed $22.3 billion by 2032. So if your lab's not thinking about this, what opportunities are you missing? So real quick, where is virtual health popular besides just about everywhere in the United States and the growth? And who's using it? That's what we need to look at. So 80% of the people surveyed in the United States have used telehealth at least once in their life. So it's whether it's a physician, pharmacist, et cetera. What you're finding also is becoming more adopted by people over 55, and the 13% increase where access is not as available in the rural settings. And it's not surprising that millennials, they prefer teleconsultations versus inpatient visits. This is all in the McKinsey report I thought was fascinating. 55% of the people believe they have better care versus with a telehealth visit. And then 52% of clinicians believe they're more effective by doing follow-ups with telehealth. So it saves them time, they're more effective. So real quick survey from Jones Lang and LaSalle. In their healthcare division, these are people that are consumer-driven for their properties, et cetera. They took a deep dive, and of this survey, the reason I bring this up, about 4,000 people, so it's significant, 50-50 mix, male and female. But what I found was the most impressive with this data is really diving deep, that 40% of the people who were surveyed were suburban, 28% were urban, 24% rural, so pretty good scattering of the thing. But the ages, 29% were baby boomers, 59 to 77, 28% were millennials, the 27 to 42s, and then the Gen X was 25% of it. So the demographics is pretty widespread from your typical patient population. But who's using telehealth? Of this 4,000 people that were using or were surveyed, half of them had used telehealth in the previous year. And the growth, well, it went down 2% from 2022 to 2023. What I'm building towards is that the types of care that they're receiving, of those surveyed, 78% of them still believed in a in-person, hands-on visit with their provider. So it's still needed. It's not going away. But telehealth continues to be a solution. But especially when it relates to the lab industry, when you can't draw blood virtually, you know, you can't have a primary care hands-on patient experience virtually, so it's still needed. And then the majority of the visits were primary care, but the primary care included lab work. So even though the advent of this solution of telehealth and virtual health is still, nothing's going to replace hands-on patient. The graphics are just killing me. So this really just talks about more about the survey of patients, of where they got their care, how they got their care, what was the care for. As we've seen in the trades, behavioral access to telehealth is a very vital component. But primary and preventative care is becoming more of an option in this solution. This is a very busy slide, but the takeaway is where the service is being used. Really, the West and the Northeast are the most vibrant population of using it. But the graph on the bottom shows the further you get away from an urban setting, the less likely you are to have telehealth. So the convenience of being in an urban setting, you know, you have more access to care, but they're more likely to use telehealth and virtual health services. So now I'd like to pass this over to Scott for him to talk about how Boston is dealing with their access to health care.
See if we can do this successfully. Is that working? Okay. First of all, thanks everybody for coming out. Really appreciate it. Unlike Brad, I actually like the typewriter font. I appreciate that Robert stayed up late on his typewriter, redoing this deck for us. Yeah. So I just wanted to share some experience with you, mostly from Boston Heart, but also, as Brad had mentioned, Boston Heart's part of Eurofins, and so we have a very broad range of laboratories, not just obviously cardiovascular testing, but transplant and other areas of specialty. So that also looks at how do you reach the patient out in the marketplace in different ways through those different testing models. You know, I also think about, I used to run a laboratory in London, and a colleague of mine who worked for a larger laboratory, we were talking about their marketing and reaching customers and reaching patients, and he looked at me like I was crazy, and part of this is British, but looked at me and said, "What do you mean? We're a lab. We do the test. The doctor orders it. And that's it." And so it reminds me how we have to get out there. We have to engage the patient in more novel ways and more aggressively to some extent to serve their needs. And so also it goes without saying that I'm not an expert at virtual care. But hopefully you'll be able to see some of the things that we've done, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and maybe, you know, some people have some ideas for us as well that we can share. But I'm looking at, first of all, where does the laboratory touch the patient, or as Brad had mentioned, now the consumer. And so, again, we're looking at a more engaged, more discerning healthcare consumer, and we're also competing with not just other care models, but the Amazons, the Apples of the world, because that's how they expect to see the care that they receive, to see the information that they are consuming. So awareness, first of all, engaging with them through information, access to care. So when they're going to see the physician or whether they're going to a telehealth visit, access to the technology, so that more of the interaction with the laboratory, collections, things like that, and then going on to intervention. So how do we support those different components of the consumer's journey through the testing world. And so just a couple examples of these things. Self-education, so awareness. Folks are out there looking on the internet, trying to figure out for themselves. Again, they're more engaged. They're more interested in these things, and primarily because they're moving from a patient to what I would term as a consumer. As Brad had mentioned, they're looking at these things in a different way. And so you've traditionally had this passive being treated type of a person, versus now they're engaged and they're acting more like a consumer. And so we have to meet those needs in a different way. And how do we do it? I mean, a lot of these things are probably typical across the industry as far as how do you deliver support and information to a healthcare consumer, and particularly a patient. Obviously online, but now we're having to reach out through different platforms like social media, influencers, anything to help them to understand the tools that are available and the information that's out there. And you know, I think it's interesting because the patients are, especially in cardiovascular care, they feel like everything's taken care of by their physician. But as they push into this realm where they're becoming more a consumer, they're looking for information. We need to help them to remember that cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer in the world. And so, again, information becomes very important to how we support the patient or customer through that process. We also can't forget about the clinician, obviously with diagnostic testing as well. And so we look at them as more of an enabler, though. They have to deliver the message to the patient. They have to be informed about these new technologies. They need to know how to engage with that patient. And so we not only help to educate them through typical routes like events and webinars, trade shows, but also at Boston Heart, we provide additional tools to both interpret the results of the laboratory testing and then also to guide their therapy to some extent as they're looking at cardiovascular disease in a more advanced manner. We're also trying to get closer to the consumer with direct-to-consumer type offerings like an app that we have. And so this is also just physically close to the consumer. So they may not be in front of their computer all the time, but everybody seems to have their phone with them. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why we provided this offering through an app is that, especially with cardiovascular care, visibility of their trajectory and their health and wellness, I think, is very important. And so being closer to the consumer really is enabled through these type of technology platforms. We also, before moving on, when we print out the test reports or provide them in PDF or what have you, we have quite a bit of support, whether it's color coding, whether it's disease information, helping them to understand what this means to them. And so, accessing that patient through the physician is still important, just making that connection and taking them all the way through the laboratory testing. The next part of it would be just, access to the technology. How do they get the test? It is very different when you're dealing with a telehealth provider trying to get blood from them. There are novel ways. There are some, more standard ways. I mean, we've been doing dry blood for quite some time in the industry. And so those ways that we're coming back to try to see how we can retool them to meet the needs of the customer in this market where they're demanding virtual care. And so we've had to push out a little bit more. It used to be just go to a patient service center. How are you able to draw this blood? Which is, there's benefits and drawbacks to all these. Obviously, if you stick a needle in somebody's arm, there's 100% compliance. You have a reduced TNPs, and you're able to get a quality sample, and you can do more testing, candidly. But, you know, some of these other delivery models, like the suction devices, we wound up going with a dry blood card that has a serum separator on it. All these different methods are meant to obviously get closer to the patient. Brad had put a stat up there about urban versus rural as well. And that's one of the things, too, that this allows, because a dry blood card doesn't require a cold chain logistics. You could send it through the post, and it really allows you to access folks that are outside of these, you know, traditional care areas. And then on the back end, how do we support that? I mean, we're obviously not the clinician, so we are not recommending medications. We're not guiding them towards a prescription. But at the same time, it's, again, with especially with cardiovascular care, helping to maintain compliance with the patient is extremely important. Helping them to support their lifestyle modifications and what have you. And so we do that, whether it's in our printed reports, we provide guidance. Again, it's more consumer-friendly, I like to think, with the color coding and the ability to help the practitioner communicate this through to the patient. But then we also do things in our app, like provide some background research, things like that, to continue this patient's journey through the testing. And how do we support that, and how do we enable them to be successful with the results that come out of the back end? So on the typewriter, they've typed up what has worked, what hasn't worked. Obviously, a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of trial and error in this. Consumers are very fickle. I think that one of the things, as I put up here, that has worked well is that, you know, looking for novel ways to interact with the patients, whether that's the app or whether that's through social media or what have you. But these things have worked well. They are a bit of a learning curve. But I think that we have started to understand a little bit more where the consumer is and what they're looking for. One thing that has been a challenge is that I find that reducing patient burden increases the lab's burden. So if you want to provide a dry blood specimen, for example, there's a lot more manual processing that goes into this. And so we have to take on the burden of validating. And, you know, they were talking yesterday about the FDA and taking things from New York State. And, I mean, we have a New York State license, but, you know, trying to get something through them is a very challenging task. And so as consumers demand these new technologies and the new ways to deliver these technologies, I think it's going to be a challenge to meet that need. Every part of our direct-to-consumer offering, you know, could be challenged there. So everything from the collection kit all the way through to how do we deliver those results to the patient? Is the algorithm the app? Does that need to go to the FDA? So a lot of things that we're going to have to manage and figure out. And so some of the things that we're thinking about in the future to better engage patients in this virtual environment, a lot of these are especially on the back end. So helping them to understand the results, ensuring compliance. So things like animated reporting, you know, things one-on-one, patient, this is what your results mean. This is somebody that really draws them in there. Again, to think about who we're competing with, the Apples, the Amazons of the world. So trying to think about it in a little different way, even though that's not the traditional lab setting, as I had mentioned with my colleague in the British lab, we have to change the way we think to be able to manage and meet the expectations of the consumer.
So the consumer willingness to pay for convenience. You can't really see that because the typewriter ran out of paper. So the consumer, I believe in the 70-30, right? 70%, as we all know, of medical decisions are based upon a lab result. 30% of the time, if you guys probably feel this, I know we got the stats, especially from the health system. 30% of the time a lab gets order gets generated, it doesn't get filled, right? Unaccounted for orders. So that's lost revenue because of lack of convenience, lack of life, you know, commitment, but life gets in the way. But when you start looking at what the consumers are willing to pay for, they would say they'd pay more if they knew the experience was convenient, right? Make it easy for me to get it done. 75% said they'd switch company if they found out their competitor was more convenient to do business with. And 68% say, you know, the customer experience is more powerful than the actual anything else, and that would make them return because that was a good leave-behind experience. And then the Price Waterhouse, on their survey, is they said, you know, consumers are really willing to pay for the qualities that matter more and the experience that matters the most. So they'll pay more for greater convenience, but they'll pay more for friendly, welcoming experience. I just touch on this one. I get my car washed at a place, and you know, if everybody's been to Chick-fil-A, you know, thank you and you're welcome, pleasure. This car wash, you go up and people are waving to you, thanks for coming to my car wash. Every single one of them. And I'm like, this is great. Why am I going anywhere else? You know, I'm not going to wash my truck. But 65% of the people, U.S. customers, find a positive experience with that company more powerful than and more influential than advertising. But a lot of money is going in towards advertising to the consumer. So I asked this question because we were built to help those satisfy the need. And people who know me have already heard me say it. We're the anti-Quest and LabCorp. We built a network to make it more convenient for everybody. But if you're a direct-to-consumer strategy and you haven't used the new technologies or haven't validated dry blood spot or any kind of the other devices to capture, you've got to have a kit, right, typically, to reach the consumer, get it in their hand. They need to have it drawn. So then you have to deal with kit logistics, right? Are you sending the kit directly to the patient? Or is the provider handing out the kit to the patient with the order to go get it drawn? Do you even have a kit? A lot of people who want to get in this market, you got to have a kit, so you got to get a kit supplier. And then is phlebotomy is performed, if it's a requirement. Is the convenience of mobile? Will you pay for it? Will the patient pay for it? We know patients will pay for convenience. Is it a brick-and-mortar solution? Is it convenient? Because a lot of people, we did a study when I helped start IGBO, that the rural communities, even though they want more access, sometimes the older generation, their experience is going to the doctor, right? You're not going to take that away from me. You don't need to come to my home. That's what I do. But if that's the case, are you making it convenient for them to go get their blood drawn? And then for a lot of labs, one of the solutions has always been, because you don't have your own patient service center network, has been in-office phlebotomy, right? And that can be ripe with the potential issues, fraud, exposure, et cetera, just because of compliance. But then, again, if you're direct-to-consumer, is your offering robust enough the patient needs to pay for the draw, or are you including it in the draw? Are you still submitting it for insurance? Is the labs willing to pay because even though it's maybe it's not a direct-to-consumer, but you're having consumers bill their insurance, is the lab paying for the collection? Is the reimbursement robust enough to compensate for that? And then would you consider split pay? Again, one of the functionalities that we perform is you let labs control cost. You know, if you're willing to pay X, will the patients pay for convenience of having somebody come to them? So we've shown that they're willing to pay for convenience as long as it's very accessible and in my line. So more considerations for your direct-to-consumer, consumer-initiated orders strategy. Where are your needs? We kind of talked about the areas where telehealth is accessible and interested in and utilized. So are you trying to do a regional need? Are you trying to do a national need? Or starting off local, toe in the water, trying to find out in certain markets? And as Scott showed, at the end of the day, when you're testing it, if decisions are made upon what you're generating as a result, how are you delivering those? Are you doing the old school? And I always say this as well in the lab industry, sometimes we're still worried about the fax machine, right? So if we're trying to automate and get into the future and deliver a virtual care, who has a fax machine anymore? But, I mean, are you sending them by mail? You're printing it and hand-delivering it. Or do you have a secured portal where they can access it and get that information so it's encrypted and secured? And then if you're doing testing, are any of the tests that are being provided, are there critical values? How are you handling that? Who's going to be the call? Who's going to make that access to the patient? And then there's others, you know, but these are the high ones that we talk about every day that you need to really consider. I'm going to hand it back over to Scott to let him talk more about how they're handling some of their virtual care.
Thank you.
Maybe next time we'll both get our own microphone, huh? If this goes well.
I think we have to go back to the typewriter.
Yeah. So again, a Boston Heart experience of walking the patient through virtual care. Again, it's about getting closer to the patient. So how do we not disrupt their lives? People are demanding not just at-home collections. They're demanding that phlebotomists come to their house. But unfortunately, they're also demanding that they don't have to pay more for it. So they've grown up in this environment where everything's paid by their insurance, and they know that insurance reimbursement is going down, but they don't really care. They still don't want to pay for it. And so it really, from a lab perspective, really makes it challenging to, you know, maintain a stable and scalable model to be able to deliver the services. But areas where, again, we touch around virtual care, obviously collection. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the solutions that we've implemented and also some of the potential solutions that we evaluated, the resulting, and then also payment too, because these are areas where in a virtual care model, patients are, again, interacting with the laboratory. So phlebotomy, as I mentioned before, you stick a needle in somebody's arm and you have really high compliance, but at the same time, I don't like to get a needle stuck in my arm. People go into patient service centers, and more often than not, waiting around in a Quest service center is not the most pleasant experience. And so, again, it's in a virtual care model, it's about how do we deliver that or make it as easy as possible for these folks to be able to get their blood drawn. Dry blood spot is great. Capillary collection is great. But at the same time, some tests just don't allow for that. You need more volume. You need different matrices. So phlebotomy is a good option. Obviously, Brad's organization helps us to match up the patient and the provider with that phlebotomy service. So, you know, looking for alternative ways to deliver that through a virtual care model. Capillary microtainer, it's an option. So this is also an area where we're exploring new devices that are not on the market yet that can collect capillary blood in microtainers much more easily. Right now, we have validated, I believe, 50 to 60 tests on capillary blood, so microtainer collection. But it's very tedious, and especially when you're talking about delivering this care in a patient's home who doesn't have a lot of experience doing this, they not only have to prick their finger, but then they have to get it over the tube, not bump it over, you know, and then seal it up properly, and then you still don't lose the challenges of the cold chain logistics that you have to get it to the lab with. Dry devices, these for us just didn't capture enough blood. They stabilize the blood well, but then in my experience only provide a whole blood sample, and then also the sample size is very, very minimal. A typical dried spot, the reason why we didn't go with this, even though you can automate it more in a laboratory, the punches and things like that, is that it only, first of all, you have to go in each spot, but then also you're not able to collect other sample types. So the dried card is what we wound up going with. We can get approximately 7 tests, depending on what type of test, out of one strip on the card. So a double card like this, we can get approximately 14 different tests. And so we have here, again, around 40 to 50 tests that are validated on this card. The suction devices are nice, too. I know that they're gaining in popularity. As Brad mentioned, people are becoming more willing to pay for this convenience. But what we found in the lab is that if you do the dried card properly, which is a challenge when you're talking about patients, the number of ways that they can screw this up is amazing. The suction device is kind of foolproof, but at the same time, it's still a device and it still has a mechanism. And so we found upwards of 15% failure rates due to loss of suction, hemolysis, other aspects for that device. And then that's only one part of the story. The other part is now you have somebody sitting in the middle of nowhere, Washington. How do you get them a kit? How do you get them to recollect? That's an expense. You have to ship it back out. These devices are getting cheaper, but they're not cheap. And so right now we've decided to not utilize this for some of those reasons, but we have a lot of experience with them as well. As I mentioned before, too, I mean, the consumer expectations, especially in a virtual care model, you know, they don't want to do anything. They don't want to pay anything, and they don't want it to disrupt their life. They don't want to go into a patient service center if they can help to. You know, for things like transplant, so some of our colleagues at ViraCore, for example, you know, going in to get their blood drawn is just part of the situation of having an organ transplant. Or, you know, paying for somebody to come and collect that sample. So some of these tests that they run are thousands of dollars. If you pay, you know, $100 to have a mobile phlebotomist come in and draw your blood, it's not such a big deal. But when you're talking about drawing for CBCs and things like that, it's very difficult to absorb those kind of costs. I talked a little bit about here about some of the benefits of phlebotomy and then also self-collection, some of the challenges that we saw. Just a snapshot of some of the things that we've validated. So primarily, you know, we did a lot of our high volume tests, you can see on the left, and then there's a lot that we are considering. These would be ones that we feel relatively confident that we could validate. But again, taking a dry blood sample for anybody who's tried to validate these things is challenging. You know, being able to replicate the results, go through the process. Some markers are really good. Genetics are really good on dry blood. Others, we started to offer insulin. We were able to validate it and then realized later on that the results weren't holding, so we had to pull it. So dry blood is still very challenging, so we're still looking for alternative options to be able to deliver care to patients. So a little bit more about the next stage, so interacting with a patient in a virtual model with lab results. I had mentioned before how we engage them through colorimetric reporting, interpretation support, and things like that. And so we even go a little bit further, you know, especially when we're talking about cardiovascular disease, is lifestyle is really important. So engaging them with useful information to help with compliance and also help to support their lifestyle changes is something that we feel is very important. Again, in the direct-to-consumer app, we give visibility of their longitudinal results, not just where they are right now, but where they've been and where they're going. Are they trending to a bad place for LDL cholesterol, for example? Or, you know, is this something where they've been bad and now they're improving? And so really engaging that patient when they're not sitting in front of the doctor and helping them to maintain the visibility and providing mechanisms to support compliance are very important. Also, one thing, you know, I'll just add about this is that I mentioned here increasing the utility of the results. And so this is, again, thinking back to that patient as a consumer. And so, you know, the cost is tied into this as well. Patients don't want to pay for something that they don't see has value. They'll go out and buy a new iPhone for $1,000 because they see a lot of value in that. They won't pay, you know, $5 for a CBC because they don't really care about that. And so if we can engage them in a way that they see and benefit from the value of the results and of the test, then that helps them to understand, you know, the benefit, and then also, you know, gets them over that price challenge. And then payment expectations, again, I think everybody's probably here dealing with this. How do we make it easy for the patient? How do we make it easier for them to pay? How do we make it easier for them to pay through their phone, things like that? And so we've been working to further develop mechanisms for the patient to either submit a payment or to understand the payment better. So a couple of things that have worked and haven't worked. Again, like I had mentioned, you know, validating the small volume, it has gone relatively well. So we have what I think is probably about the most robust list of dry blood testing for cardiometabolic disease. You know, and we have an ability to reach the patient in virtual care models, whether they're, you know, in downtown New York or whether in the middle of nowhere. I saw a kid go out to somebody in Hawaii the other day. And so, you know, these things get a lot easier when you have collection methods that support that. But it's been a challenge to be able to meet these needs and the demands of the consumers. Collection issues, as I mentioned before, with the suction devices, there's just innate problems with those mechanisms. The dry blood card, though, too. You know, we had a patient once that they sent in their dry blood card, and it had literally one drop of blood on the card. And so I personally wrote them a note, and I said, you know, we have all the information, we have directions, we have a video, we have, you know, instructions in the kit, we have things on our website. And so I wrote him a personal note, though, with some recommendations of how to collect enough blood, the different things you do, you know, how much we need, watch for it to migrate, send him out another kit, and it comes back, and it looks like a massacre. And so you just can't, I mean, it's amazing the things that patients can screw up. And so, you know, anything you can do to lower that barrier, to make it easier for them, to make it stupid-proof, you know, also not to rag on the patients too much, but they don't do this every day. So, you know, we think about collecting a blood sample, and it's, you know, it seems pretty straightforward, but, you know, somebody out in the community who's always had their blood drawn and a dry blood kit shows up the doorstep, it looks nice and everything, but they don't really get it. So anything we can do to help enable that and support it, especially in a virtual care where you don't have somebody interfacing with the patient as they're doing it, is very important. And then I had mentioned this before too, the things that we're kind of looking at, looking into the future, is again, around how do we get a sample from a patient that is, not laborious for them, it's easy to do, and it's relatively inexpensive. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of companies out there looking at how to solve this, through different types of devices, whether it's on your arm, on your finger, or what have you. And so I think that there are some interesting developments that are on their way out to the marketplace soon. And so, you know, something that can both be more consistent in collecting a larger volume of blood, but then also have a cost that is tenable for the laboratory to be able to deliver these services.
All right, so then the third element, or the last element here, is lab connectivity, right? You got to generate an order, you got to get the specimen in, you got to generate the results, and then deliver those results. So lab connectivity is vital to this virtual environment. So there's a lot of different options out there. I could be here. Everybody knows a lot of players in there. These are some of the ones we work with for direct-to-consumer options. Obviously, order entry by a provider, Avexia and Rupa are in the play. Enterprise options, I don't know if there's anybody from LK in the room. But they're up there. And national ordering provider networks, other ordering solutions that have innovative technology, and then groups like LabSavvy that also bring a lot of variety of taking paper prints into digital output. But specimen collections, it all starts there, right? Labs, you can't just make up results. You got to take a substrate, test it, generate a result. So this is where I'm most passionate about. And I said this before, 70% of all clinical decisions are based upon a lab result. You got to get the specimen in, right? So access to this, Quest and LabCorp have the two biggest footprints out there. There's a third player that's in the room as well that's creeping up on them and will surpass them by Q3. But there's new collection methods that Scott talked about, dry blood spot, you know, the suction devices for capillary. But will patients comply? You can make it as easy as possible. You still got to get the specimen in to be able to test it. So, and then at the end of the day, can you validate for your needs? We know COVID, everybody had to wrap their head around how do I survive? So it can be done. It's just committing the resources and time. So I'm not going to reiterate what Scott already talked about, dry blood spot, pros and cons, you know, proper capture. Your bio has got a new collection device, obviously, with the capillary, just as Tasso does. So there's options out there. What are you going to use? How are you going to use it? And does it make sense? So before I go into the Q&A, so my background, and I've been a product manager of pharmaceuticals, and I was there when Celdane was the first direct-to-consumer advertising for pharmaceuticals. So what were the requirements? USA Today, full-page ad, awesome. Back page, full disclosure, right? You had to have that. So if we're thinking about convenience, positive experience, and effectiveness, every night I'm looking at watching TV with my wife, 30% of the commercials are for pharmaceuticals. You know, I don't know I need all this stuff, but I'm thinking I do because they're pretty effective. Why isn't the lab world able to talk about their testing, especially if you're looking for a direct-to-consumer model? So would your lab benefit by exposing your test offerings to today's healthcare consumer in states that allow direct access testing? You know, but how are you going to get there? And then once you decide that, how are you going to deliver it from the capture, the order, the delivery, et cetera? Things to consider in this day and age. So I always like to leave with a little bit of a blurb. So today's healthcare and testing environment is evolving. What are you doing to position yourself to succeed with some of the technology, processes, and solutions that are available to you today, people that are here at this conference? But are you ready to invest the time, the money, and resources to adapt to this evolving healthcare consumer? Strategic, right? You got to figure out where you want to be, how you're going to get there, because the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So, thank you. We'll open it up now for some questions. Oh, this slide did stay intact. And if anybody wants the real good-looking version of this slide deck, you can ping me on WOVA, and I'll send it over to you in a PDF because it does look nice versus traditional. So, any questions? Yes. So the question is, how does today's younger consumer try to address their needs with reimbursements going down or insurance coverage trying to access it? Is that the question?
And just the psychology of other alternative payment models other
than the standard insurance model. Yeah. So the stats that we talked about that I live with every day, 40% of the population does not have a primary care provider relationship, right? So they're seeking alternative care. If, and I talk to a lot of millennials, they hold off and push off to anything related to healthcare because I'm bulletproof. And I used to be one of those bulletproof people until I turned 60. That's not about me. It's about the millennials and how they're trying to access it. They don't, like Scott said, people expect to be taken care of, right? We don't have socialized medicine here in the States. You got to pay some form of ride. You got to co-pays, et cetera. What we're seeing is that a lot of our lab clients are going direct to consumer, even though it's a physician-generated order. But if the worried well are willing to pay for it as you get a little bit older and you're more consumed, then those trends are there. For the younger consumer, a lot of people are saying, I don't need it, what we hear. But a lot of the testing that we're doing is for more functional people who are really committed to their health and their tests that are evolving different or giving different results to affect it. So in the field of cardiovascular, since I helped start Cleveland Heart Lab, you're 12 times more likely to die of a cardiovascular-related event than all cancers combined. If you're diagnosed with cancer, you're running to the doctor to figure it out for the most case. So the modern psychology of, you know, what is their why? I believe in that Simon Sinek, what is your why, right? Do you want to live longer, to watch your child get married? I think the younger generation is really skeptical about healthcare in general, but if they do it, it's because they're told to get it done, and it's a last-minute type of occurrence. Now, I don't have the statistics behind it. That's just what we're hearing from the trades and some of our labs that we're doing business with. So roundabout way to say everybody's psychology in different regions of the country are, you know, a healthier environment might create a healthier patient who's more active in their healthcare. But the people who are in the older populations who struggle to get access to good healthcare are more committed to do whatever they're told to do. So.
And I'll just add to that. Our experience is that, you know, cash is the fastest growing area of our business. And so I think that the expectation of some level of burden for the patient is they're warming up to that. But also we can't forget the provider in this. They've become a salesperson for us. So we need to give them tools and enable them with the ability to help the patient understand the value of this. And so they don't like to do that, but the more tools we give to help get the patient over that hump, if they see the value in it, then I think the psychology is, well, I'm willing to pay for something that impacts my health versus something that I really just don't understand and my doctor's just telling me to do.
Yeah, in that regard, I think it's really important to get the providers buy-in, right? Do you, have you encountered this, that they, the providers actually feel, if I recommend this kit to my patient, I don't make any profit out of it, right? It's like taking away their business partially. But I think if you view it from the other angle, they're helping their patient to have better health. Yeah. How do you perceive that?
It's a difficult balance. You don't want to alienate your providers because, first of all, they're the majority of our business. And also, they're just so critical to the care of the patient. But at the same time, the patients are demanding these services. And so, you know, the way that I've looked at it so far is that we provide different offerings. So in our example at Boston Park, the app that we provide direct to consumers, it's not providing everything that we do directly to the consumer to say, okay, well, you were going to your doctor to get this, well, now you can just stay at home and get this. It's, hey, this is a different way of providing support for your health journey. So.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.